is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
I'm John Batchelor. It is a great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Wapshot, the author of Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Market, a new book that takes us back to the 20th century and then forward to the 21st century to settle a debate that cannot be settled between two schools of economic thinking. One represented famously by John Maynard Keynes, the other represented famously by Friedrich Hayek. The Hayekians, the Keynesians, but their disciples, Samuelson and Friedman. So we begin with an event. It is June of 1980. Inflation has peaked. Runaway inflation has peaked, but they do not know. Paul Volcker is in the audience. He is now the man who's making decisions at the Fed. And the speaker is Milton Friedman of the Chicago School. Nicholas, congratulations and a very good evening to you. And your book is a treat. If I'd read it as a younger man, I would have been less perplexed by the events of these last decades when I realized that these men, these significant economic theoreticians, were intimate friends and correspondents and cared a great deal about each other and their families. But this day, in June of 1980, Milton Friedman launches an ad hominem attack on the decisions made by Paul Volcker. You describe him with his tall frame in the audience sticking above all the other seated guests. And the ad hominem attack is blunt. What is the case that Milton Friedman makes? And how is it that Paul Volcker is able to respond, "Oh, Milton"? Good evening to you, Nicholas.
Good evening, John. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again. Yeah, this is an absolutely key moment in the battle between the Hayekians and the Keynesians, but 50 years later after the event. And they are making decisions about exactly how to purge hyperinflation from the system. By the 70s, everybody was in despair. The Keynesians couldn't understand why runaway inflation had taken place. Milton Friedman thought he had the idea, which was to do with the monetary theory. How much money is in the system guides how much inflation there is. And so he says what you ought to do is just turn the taps off or turn the taps down. Volcker's doing this, but he's not doing it as Milton wants. Milton wants a set program. Volcker's playing it by ear. And actually, as it turns out, as you say, he didn't know he got it right, but he had got it right. And so Milton, thinking that Volcker was doing something completely wrong because he wasn't following what Milton said, attacked him in this public forum, which is most unusual. Of all the great academic debates and political debates, the people behind the scenes rarely hit each other in public. But Milton was a very interesting character. He was a Brooklynite, and he was a little feisty. I mean, I say little. He's about 5'7". He was a little chess prodder. He had arguments with everybody. He was... Groucho Marx once sang a song saying, whatever it is, I'm against it. And Milton had that reputation for always being the contrarian in the room. And he was contrary when it came to politeness, too. And that is, he should have kept quiet and mentioned it to Volcker behind his back. In private, behind closed doors. But he didn't. He launched a very public attack on Volcker.
Samuelson, Paul Samuelson, who is... the esteemed economist and post-Keynesian, that's his own term for himself, at MIT, writes of this event, "I am not one loath to criticize the Federal Reserve. There is no other activity that so much adds to the economist's professional and self-esteem. One of the joys of your book is how dry their wit is. I wonder if they take a course in it before they get their PhDs." All right, let's go forward 26 years. Milton Friedman leaves us at the age of 94 in November of 2006. However, he has a posthumous column in the Wall Street Journal published the next day. Money Matters. In that, he makes the same case he's made for decades. What is that case, despite all of the vicissitudes of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and good heavens, we're about to come to the Great Recession? What is the case, Nicholas?
The case is that the Keynesians had come to the conclusion that you could actually throw money around. You could borrow it endlessly. If your economy was in trouble, if it was sinking, you just hosed money at it. And people from Hayek onwards on the conservative side of this debate would argue, hold on a minute. There's a cost to all of this. There will be a cost. It'll come out in inflation or one way or another. Something will go terribly wrong. And the Keynesians said, oh, leave that to us. We'll sort it out. And what this, yes, his posthumous message was actually money still matters. Money's still important. There is a price to all of this. Like there's a price to quantitative easing, he would say today. He didn't live in the age of quantitative easing officially, which is where governments borrow their own money effectively in order to pump more money into the system. Milton believed that, and there's some logic in it. If you think about it for a second, it's common sense. The more money there is in a system, the higher prices will go as more money chases fewer goods.
The price is paid beginning a year later. And it's like falling down the steps. November of 07, Fannie and Freddie reported $2 billion loss. And then we go through what is a hall of shame. What we have now is IndyMac fails in California. We also have the questions at BNP Paribas, meaning this is a global crisis driven by the real estate excesses. The following March, Bear Stearns fails. After that, with J.P. Morgan and the government stepping in, there's the term Frankenstein in financial engineering. Lehman's fails in mid-September of 2008. The panic sets in. Congress gets involved. TARP. And the Great Recession is on. I mention all this very quickly, Nicholas, because Samuelson's still with us. He doesn't leave us till 09. And Friedman is gone. At this point, what does the Great Recession illustrate between these two poles? Samuelson arguing post-Keynesian when in a recession, Friedman saying no, control the amount of money and the velocity of money, and the market will take care of itself.
Yeah, the great irony, of course, was that the person who actually allowed so much cheap money was Alan Greenspan, at the time considered a total maestro when chairman of the Fed. And he was charged with ensuring there wouldn't be a recession after the terrorist attacks on America of 2001. And he put, effectively, money rates down to almost zero. So it didn't cost anything to borrow anything. And cheap money, however, did, as you say, allowed people to lend money to people who really couldn't afford to pay it back if there was a real interest rate. So people were, in the old days, when you wanted to buy a house, you had to prove to the lender that you could afford the repayments. But in those early 2000s, not at all. It was given to all sorts of people. And the crisis took place when actually, strangely, a French bank spotted that there was about to be a terrible event. That is, that the banks, American banks in particular, wouldn't lend to each other overnight. The whole system would freeze up. So they sent a small email saying, don't lend anything to American banks. Don't pass it on to American banks anymore. That was spotted, and it triggered the events of 2008 when the whole financial structure froze.
And crowding in on this now are the Keynesians, I believe. Is that a way to characterize the Obama administration? I remember Paul Volcker's tall frame sitting next to the president, the Senator Obama, a candidacy. It was an event in Florida. Are the Keynesians vindicated by the remedy for the Great Recession?
Well, there's no other remedy, it turns out. The conservative economists, either to their shame or to their great credit, kept quiet. They didn't have a solution at all. But the Keynesians did, or the post-Keynesians did, and they said, you just have got to hose more money at the system. It's a bizarre thought. In fact, of course, it was George W. Bush's plan that Obama put into effect. It was slightly before Obama arrived, and Obama just swallowed it wholesale and went off with it. But it was made up by Keynesians. So George W. presided over two things. Alan Greenspan, who was considered a genius, but then lent his policies, his brain really, to endorsing the fact that cheap money was essential to prevent America going into, or the world going into, recession. And then, at the end of George W.'s time, when the banks started to freeze up, as one of the Keynesians said, everybody's a Keynesian in a foxhole. The fact is that when you're up against the wall and nothing you can do except borrow money is the solution, you borrow money. And that's what happened. And since then, money has cost almost zero. There has been no interest rate. If you're a saver, you haven't got any money in your savings account. You've got no interest per year. People on retirement have suffered as a great result of this. And it's difficult to know who to benefit, except for the fact that the whole world economy didn't go off a cliff as it might have done. We might have ended up... Ben Bernanke, who was also chairman of the Fed a little later, did a study and came to the conclusion that had it not been for the intervention of that Bush-Obama solution, that there would have been a recession or a depression even worse than the 29-31 depression in the United States. And he's a conservative. I mean, you know, there's nothing in it for him to get it wrong.
We've laid out what we can so far know of this debate between Keynes and Hayek, between Samuelson for Keynes and Friedman for Hayek. So back to the beginning, the birth of Mr. Friedman and the birth of Mr. Samuelson and their education in Depression America. The book is Samuelson Friedman, The Battle Over the Free Market. Nicholas Wapshot is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.